This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You're in the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
Good evening, faithful listeners. You're listening to the Spirit Lounge here on Joy 94.9 every Thursday from 8 until 9. My name is Tal Meretz, and tonight I'm going to have quite a fun time. I'm talking to Rida Alim Khan, but first we'll be covering our holy day of the week. Yeah, so I'm still playing that one as our holy day theme. So holy day of the week, of course. Some of you might not have been listening to the show before, but this is where we cover a religious festival that is going on this week. That way people can find out about it before it happens, unlike most people who usually find out about some holiday of a religious tradition. They only end up finding out about it after it's already happened. But this one is called, I pronounce it Laylat al-Qadr. Is that a good way to pronounce it?
Yeah, you're funny. It's actually Laylatul Qadr.
Laylat al-Qadr.
Yeah.
Is that acceptable?
Yeah, okay, kind of acceptable. Sure. Yeah. I think you know, it is a different pronunciation when it comes down to Arabic versus English anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy to say that I'm wrong. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay. They just call it the Night of the Power. That's the translation. Night of the Power.
Well, so this is Rida. This is my guest. So I thought rather than me doing, a good 10-minute monologue about an issue, I thought we may as well ask my guest, seeing she is actually Muslim and so would actually be a part of this festival. So why don't you actually tell us a little bit about what is the purpose of this festival?
Sure. So basically, the Night of Power is actually a chapter in the Quran called Chapter Qadr or Surah Qadr, which is the chapter about the Night of the Power. And it's a very small chapter. It's only like 5 verses, and it's the 97th chapter. And it says that we have indeed revealed this message in the Night of Power, and what we'll explain to thee what the Night of Power is. The Night of Power is better than 1,000 months. Therein come down the angels and the spirit by Allah's permission on every errand peace. This until the rise of dawn. So basically, it's been believed for hundreds of years, or probably now over 1,000 of years, that Laylatul Qadr is a night where people that really, really want to achieve something desperately in life, or there's a goal, there's something that they really desire to have, then they should stay up all night and worship. And the power of that worshipping equals to the 100, like 1,000 days of worshipping, or what does it say here? 1,000 months of worshipping.
Right. So people do their worship. Is it on their own, or do they do it? Do people gather on the Night of Power?
Different things people can do. There's a practice called itikaf, which people do during Ramadan, as we still have that holy month going. And in itikaf, what this person, the one family member, among your family, like, is going to sit in a room isolated away from the rest, and they're going to not be they're going to be given their food without any contact, or like through a, like, probably just swoop down the dish or whatever the food along, and they can, you know, just have access to their own private toilet or whatever for during itikaf, during that ritual. And it tends to be that during that kind of ceremony, to have this Night of Power coming around Ramadan, it's very important, because it can kind of double your deeds, good deeds, that is. And, yeah, so that's pretty much the significance of it. But some people do it in isolation. Others, like, for example, my mom, she does it throughout the night, reads the Quran. You can pray. You can do zikr. As a Sufi Muslim, we're more into doing zikr. So we have, a Sufi gathering tonight, right now, happening. And I'm here.
Well, so we're taking you away.
That's okay.
But thank you. Thank you still for coming on. So you say, obviously, as a result, people would be doing the sort of isolation type prayer. Is that because it happens to be at the same time as Ramadan this year? But
that's
if it
right.
wasn't, would people be doing something different?
I think, yeah, the ritual etikaf, it's only usually done in Ramadan. So night of power kind of comes, you know, like different times of the month according to the lunar calendar. But this year it just happens to fall on the same time as Ramadan. So, yeah.
And so at other times, might they instead do the study or this? Or
that's right.
It's a community.
Usually the worshipping is the same. It's the reading of the Quran or the reading through the rosemary beads or reading passages by Prophet Muhammad. And in general, I think it's, trying to really understand. And I've always been told it's more like a repentance night where whatever forgiveness you ask from God, you can get it from God. So I've always been raised up believing that instead of seeing it as a opportunity to double my good deeds.
point scoring.
Yeah.
Double. The way you said it, it reminded me of, like, you know, game shows. It's always the last round. It's like,
is that,
double points.
Double points, yeah. Exactly. And it's like, I don't know if that's what it is. I think it's, in my understanding, it's more about repenting
So why is it that this time is the, why is this night the night of power?
There's I think it's an interesting question because it's surely not among the commandments within the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's not among the even the Islamic commandments. So it's just something that's there in the Quran that the 97th chapter just points out about the night of the power. I don't really know if that's to do with any other thing. I mean, it has been believed that it is this night when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. I mean, that could be the biggest, you know, historical significance in itself.
Makes sense.
Sounds
fairly significant.
This is the night when the Quran was chosen to reveal to Prophet Muhammad, and therefore, you know, at the time he kind of ran away. He couldn't, and it's a little bit, it's because the story goes something like that Prophet Muhammad was meditating in a cave, and Angel Gabriel came and said, read, and Prophet Muhammad's like, I can't, and he's like, read, and he says, I can't, and read, and I can't, and then it's like,
then what happened?
And then he starts reading, and then it's like, whoa, freaked out, and that's the night of Qadr, the night of power.
It makes sense. I mean, I don't want to speculate, obviously, too much when I'm not entirely sure, but I'd be interested to know whether or not that was always what it was in reference to, or whether or not sometimes I think in all religions, sometimes we have an event and then afterwards we start to go, well, hang on, let's try and find the, you know, sometimes certain events get attached to those festivals afterwards. So I'd be interested to know the history of where that came from.
I'm glad that, yeah, you asked that question. I think in Pakistani culture, people tend to, like, give food on this night. So my house in Pakistan, I think mom was telling me that, oh, my God, I'm making all this food. I'm like, what for? It's like, oh, it's Laylatul Qadr. And I'm like, oh, right, mom, what did you make? And she made this date soup kind of thing, which is extremely sweet, and she's planning to give it to all the neighbors and your, like, relatives, and I think that's one of the practices that have come along with time. But I don't know if there's any festival as such, possibly because the celebration of Quran in general is the month of Ramadan. So basically that you have the month of Ramadan, which is when the Quran was revealed. And then the night of power is when the
it's like the event, sort of the precise, beginning of it. Yeah,
the precise date as to which when the Quran was revealed. And then Eid is a celebration of the fact that Quran was revealed.
Right.
So it's like kind of the same thing,
that,
except...
That happens. Yeah. Well, look, so this will be on the... That's Sunday evening? The 12th... I've got 12th of July.
That's right, yeah.
So it's 12th... So it's, is it from the 12th? That's the night itself. So it's kind of like...
Till the dawn of the 13th of July, yeah.
Okay, so...
That's right.
So if you happen to see anyone, you know, maybe giving each other sweets or maybe seem to be a little isolated on the 12th of July evening, please don't kick open their door and try and yell at them, because they're actually trying... They might be trying to celebrate... Hang on, I'm going to pronounce it. Laylat al-Qadr?
Yes.
How's
yes,
that?
That's not too bad.
Not pronounce I'm pronouncing it al-Qadr. Probably like the way it sounds in Hebrew. So mine's a bit off. But look, thank you very much for that. And you're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. And faithful listeners, I'm talking to Rita Alim Khan. Now, Rita is here to, I guess we're going to talk a little bit about you and all that sort of thing. But so why don't we start actually just talking about you. You're originally from Pakistan.
Yeah, that's right. I was born in Pakistan. Yes.
When did you come to Australia?
I came to Australia in 2005 and I grew up in a country town.
Right. So, but you're Muslim, but you're specifically a Sufi Muslim.
Muslim, so, that's right, yeah.
So why don't you tell us maybe just a little bit about what the unique aspects about Sufi Islam are?
Sure. So basically, I think I chose to become a Sufi at the age of 16. And that was also the year when I left home and started to live by myself. And I decided to follow Sufi Islam simply because I couldn't really resonate with the Sunni and the Shia and the other two main domains of Islam, which majority of the people are. And Sufis are in itself a minority within the minority in Australia. So there's only about 100 of us in Victoria. And there's different aspects of Sufi faith which I like. I mean, there's four paths to becoming a better Muslim in Sufism. The first path is the path of knowledge, where you're actually gaining the knowledge and you're actually studying and analyzing and understanding things. Then the second path happens to be the sense of responsibility or the sense of duty you have towards doing good for the world around you. So that's the second path. And the third path is the self-discipline path. And the fourth path is the path where you devote your life to the well-being of society as well as the divine and the universe. So for me, these three structured paths kind of helped me become a better Muslim and a better person, which was different from the mainstream Islam, which is the Sunni and Shia Islam, which was more along the sides of do what you're told, obey the instructions, completely surrender without rationally reasoning, as I understand it. Like, so I kind of felt a little bit uncomfortable with the whole Sharia law and all of that. So, yeah, so Sufism kind of came through the mystical side of Islam, a bit more softer side of Islam, as I would understand it.
So I didn't realize this, but your family is not Sufi.
That's right. So my family is they're Sunnis. They're Sunni Muslims, and specifically there are Sunni Hanafi Muslims, which is a sect within the Sunni sect. but that's because we have so many different sects.
So does that actually, how did your family feel about you, I guess, in a sense, converting? Maybe that's a bit of a strong term.
Yeah, they weren't, I think at the time they were a bit confused. They were like, okay, yeah, Sufism is good because of their music and all the enchanting they do, but why not still be a Sunni and a Sufi at the same time? And I said to like my family, because they're just not the same. I know you think that's the same, but it's just not, because the the way Sufis live, and one of the basic features of Sufism beside the four paths is the fact that you have a chain of teachers that you follow. So my sheikh, my Sufi sheikh, my teacher has his own teacher who has his own teacher who has his own teacher. And there's like a chain that's been followed from hundreds of years and kind of sticking to that. And then you become a disciple of them, and then you become a teacher yourself, and then you have your own students and so on and so forth. So you gotta have that chain of Sufism within your faith, which isn't the case with Sunni Islam, because any mullah, any imam, any guy practically who has economical support in society or a social support in society can claim to be an imam or a teacher of Islam, whereas in Sufism that's not the case. Like, you literally have to get qualified and get permission from your teacher, your teacher's teachers, and so on and so forth. So it's a little bit different in the way the whole sect kind of operates within Islam. And yeah,
it seems though you're also though attracted to what you at least saw as something, as you said, a bit softer, maybe something a bit do you think you identify, obviously your faith is very important to you, but that you're someone who sort of isn't so much into the rules following. I don't know how else I'd put it.
Yeah. I hear you, because I think one of the basic understandings of Sufism, as I see, is it's a catalyst faith. So if a Christian comes to a Sufi, the Sufi is going to help that Christian become a better Christian. If a Hindu comes to a Sufi, the Hindu is going to get help to become a better Hindu. So the faith itself, Sufism, it doesn't itself preach anything. It's only a catalytic kind of group support to help you become stronger in what you already believe in, or to help you become a better person, whichever way you feel you are more inclined towards suiting for yourself. So I would say, yeah, I'm not that big of a rule follower. No, I'm not. And I guess it's important for me to kind of have that ability to ijtihad, which is known as the independent reasoning in Islam. So I strongly believe that, and things like, you know, Allah says in the Quran that, you know, always stand by justice, even if that be against your parents or your family or your relatives, a friend or a rich or a poor, and things like that. I think for me, I've always had this sense of social justice. And when I saw that within the Sunni or the Shia Islam, I saw that there were men and women weren't really being treated the same, I decided to leave that sect, because I cannot agree with something which actually does preach some way, some kind of inequality. For example, as a Sunni Muslim woman, I cannot go to a mosque during my periods. And I also cannot touch the Quran during my periods. And I'm not okay with that. I'm not okay with that, because to me, that's gender discrimination. And therefore, when I become a Sufi Muslim, there is no such kind of restrictions. And mm-hmm. it's more like it's very emotionally rational, or rationally emotional, however you want to understand. But it's really about being, as a Sufi, you have to be true to your heart and to your mind. Like, there has to be this heart conviction inside where a lot of emphasis is. So whereas in the Sunni Islam, it's more about, or the Shia Islam, it's more about following the traditions, adhering to the traditions, not questioning them. And that makes life really kind of difficult for me as a person. Yeah.
So was any of this related at all to why you moved out at 16?
Yeah, definitely. I think, like, I have a twin brother, so he always kind of got away with things like staying off late at his friend's house, and I couldn't really do that. So things like that. And then also when he expressed his opinions, he was more like, oh, you're so smart. And when I expressed my views, they were like, oh no, don't have too much opinion, because, you know, you're eventually going to find a guy who wouldn't like someone who's that opinionated. And you know, there's all this kind of, I mean, one can argue that a lot of this was cultural, you know, Pakistani cultural influence. But on the other hand, the fact that I was, my family asked me to wear headscarf and my own mother did not wear headscarf, like, it kind of didn't make sense to me. So yeah, it was like, for me, it's a bit like, it's odd. I think Pakistani people are odd, but when you bring kind of religion as justification for some of the things, it makes it very difficult to get convinced inside as a person. I think it was because of that, you know, I really kind of left home and I was like, hey, Dad, you know what? You guys better live in Pakistan and I better like live by myself and everything. So it was kind of better off that way.
Right. And so when you originally moved here, you actually yourself, you said you were originally in a country town. You actually did radio there.
Yes, I did. And I did a show called Colorful Australia with Triple H Radio, and it's Triple H because of Horsham. That's where I was. So
Colorful Australia, that sounds suspiciously like some kind of GLBTI show.
that sounds like that, but it's it was actually literally just looking at the different racial colors as well as the religious and the diversity within Australian culture in general. And I would have, yeah, so I worked in the Triple H radio in Horsham, and then I went and worked at Polyphonics for some time, ethnic community in Melbourne. Then I worked at Radio Monash. So, yeah.
Wow, long history. And so yeah. I know you did actually often talk about, let's backtrack for a bit. You're bisexual.
Yes, that's right. Happen to be a bisexual
so,
Muslim.
Yeah, that's right. So I end up, as I said, you know, I end up interviewing a Sufi Muslim originally from Pakistan who's bisexual, and it sounds really like, oh my goodness, what an interesting
combination.
I guess we'll come back, but so you were happy to talk about that obviously on air.
Of course it's nothing to really kind of it's just part of your life, like my life, and yeah.
And how did you feel like that was received? Because I mean, you weren't necessarily it's not a GLBTI environment or a show, like you're a Joy, right? You're talking often with about cultural minorities and stuff like that. And was that received okay?
I think me and bisexuality, first of all, it kind of it was something I knew, but I never really acted on it. So I think as a Muslim bisexual, the way I conduct my life is very different from a Western bisexual person. So in that, what I'm trying to say is that I don't necessarily feel the need to marry a woman because I want to have biological kids, and I'm not going to marry a woman because I want to have biological kids. And for me, I often say to people that my sexual orientation may not be my choice, but what I do with my sexuality is my choice. And therefore, in that, when I realized that I was bisexual for the first time, I wasn't scared, because, in fact, I was kind of relieved when I discovered that. But at the same time, just like back when I was heterosexual and I wasn't sleeping around with anyone, just like that, becoming a bisexual like didn't really change me. It was just like, okay, it's something that's part of my sexuality.
You just realize
something. There's another surface to it. Okay, great. But, you know, I'm not going to sleep around and have casual or open relationships. I'm still a Muslim.
I'm talking to Rida Alim Khan. Now, before we do continue, you did want to quickly backtrack on something we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, that's right. I just wanted to say that I made a mistake earlier saying that the night of power, Lailatul Qadr, comes different time of the year. It actually doesn't. It's always within the last 10 days of Ramadan. And I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, because we got in a... It's all right. It's easy. Sometimes I obviously, we do that sometimes. You get on and a bit deer in the headlines. Yeah. And suddenly you're like, and it's like this.
But yeah, so again, it goes back to what I said earlier, which is the Ramadan is the month where Quran was revealed, the holy book, and the night of power is when...
Always part of that, yeah.
Yeah,
I understand. Thanks for that one. And now let's just come back. So, as you're kind of saying, so what is your community's stance, I guess, or sort of from your sect when it comes to dating?
Dating, sure. So when I say my sect is Sufism, so Sufism is pretty cool with it, but there's a but, and that but is the fact that the mainstream Muslim community in Australia is not okay with dating. They're not okay with homophobia. They're not okay with homophobia, but they're also not okay with being gay or lesbian or bisexual and whatnot. And I think I don't know if it's fear of being gay, but it's just this understanding that Western world is so focused on its sexuality, which it is to an extent, that as Muslims we must be against it. And I think time and time again, I found myself speaking to friends that sometimes go against Australia because of American media, which is not the same thing. Because when you go back to Pakistan or Iraq or Iran, what you get exposed to a lot of the times is the American media, the HBO star movies, Dr. Phil, Oprah Winfrey, you know, those kind of, you know, figures. And they have a very different approach and a very aggressive media in America, I feel, compared to Australia. And often Australia gets taken to be the American, like the Americans, like the West, like everyone else. So I think the community here probably needs to do a bit more interfaith dialogues and in general more interaction. But yes, they're not okay with dating. But having said that, there are so many Muslim and Indian and Afghani online websites for matrimony. And ever since Nokia phone came to Afghanistan and the India and Pakistan, just because they don't tell you that they're single or just because they don't tell you, everyone knows that, you know, if you have a phone, you're likely to be dating someone.
Right. So it's interesting. You're sort of saying, you know, oh, just because I'm, you know, I mean, sometimes stereotypically and obviously to some degree, you know, we can say comparatively that us in the West might be, you know, getting around, so would like to or don't mind. But you're saying also you're quite comfortable with dating. So how do you sort of make...
Yes.
Maybe make the distinction there of what we're talking about.
So for me, like dating, the practice of dating, the whole exercise is, the whole point of it is to get to know someone with the intention of relationship. And I don't think that anyone would disagree with me on that in Australia.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah. And so given that, it's unless it's casual dating, like I don't do that. I don't think most Muslims don't do that, though I would say be careful there.
As always, I always think we always have an in theory.
On the other hand, so I date with the intention of a relationship, and then hopefully, for me, a relationship and a marriage is the same thing, because in Australia, de facto relationship is actually recognized by law. So for me, that's if the government of the country I'm living in is recognizing my relationship by law or through on the paper as in with Centrelink or whatever, then to me that is marriage and that's good enough. But obviously for a lot of Muslims, they think that no, there has to be that Sharia law recognition. And for them, that's the real marriage. The Australian de facto relationship recognition does not hold as much significance to them.
And so are you out within your community?
I am. I have. Look, dude, I tried so hard to find a really nice Muslim guy in my own community and in United States and England and Canada. Yeah, okay. I've been to every dating website possible, but I think after I was kicked out of singlemuslims.com because of my apparently frank views on LGBT, and there's all this bunch of guys started sending me messages trying to preach me about Islam, and I'm like, dude, I'm not here for that. Like, I was being honest so that you know my views. It wasn't because, you know, you'd message me, it was horrible. And and they deleted my profile, literally saying that, oh, your profile is offending. It's very offensive and it's offending many people. And I was like, okay, well, fine, screw you. And they literally, you know, I think the Muslim community, if anything, the elders need to realize that when they act in such an immature way, they push away people like myself from our faith. So they are partially to blame in that, but at the same time.
And what about within the Sufi community? You're out,
Yep.
And what was, the response?
The Sufis, they were cool with it. They were like, oh, wow, no, not a big deal. But, you know, it wasn't like, you are going to go to hell or, you are the disciple of Satan or none of that. Yeah, Sufis were pretty chill. They were like, oh, okay. So, yeah.
And how is that, you know, how was that experience then ultimately?
It kind of gave me a sense of belonging and a sense of acceptance. My non-Muslim friends were already accepting of me as a bisexual Muslim and as a liberal Muslim, as a Sufi Muslim, as a girl in general. But it's the Sufi Muslims that kind of really felt that, hey, there's someone who still wants to be a Muslim. So and she's still gonna wanna marry a guy because she wants to have a biological child. And yet for some reason we are somehow kind of telling her off to get out of our community or yada yada yada. So we shouldn't be doing that. And I think in general Sufis tend to be very accepting and liberal. So in fact a lot of Sufi dancers in the past, especially around 1400s, tend to be gay people from Indian Pakistani backgrounds. And in our understanding of Islam, it's more so the usage of boys for your sexual pleasure. That's, in our understanding of Islam, is forbidden, because there were times within the history of Persian Empire and Roman Empire and Byzantine Empire where young boys were forced and used as slaves to satisfy desires of the, or sexually satisfy the the rich at the time. And
so you think that as a result, homosexuality sort of been basically, as people sometimes still do, it's been coupled with pedophilia.
That's right.
And you're saying that's sort of an unfair
connection joint. There. So that's my understanding. And largely, I find Quran to be fairly silent about it. There's only one or two verses where it says men raping men is not allowed, which is...
There's a key term there that you put in, yeah.
And, yeah.
I did want to ask, Rita, now, obviously sometimes people would say, well, I always knew I was gay or whatever it might be. And then there are others, of course, where it takes time and they realize. And it seems from what you're saying, you know, you didn't always know.
Mm.
There was sort of at some point that you realized you were attracted to women. What... when was that?
I think it's it took time. Like, again, I come from a Pakistani society, so sex is not something we talk about. And then I went to a country town where sex is always talked about. So,
so what a change.
Yeah. So it was like, guys, yeah, calm down. So it was like... I wasn't really given a safe environment where I could, like, literally explore my sexuality and have a break from the two extremes that I was, coming from. So, basically, when I was a kid, I would always, like, there's a way we speak Urdu, the language, and when we speak that language... there's a way a man would say certain things, and there's a way when women would say certain things. So,
can you give us an example?
Right. So, if I want to say I want to go out, in English, it applies the same way to a man and a woman. I want to go out. Yeah, that's it. But in Urdu, if a woman wants to say this, she says, "Main bahar jana chahti hoon," and if a man wants to say it, "Main bahar jana chahta hoon." So. There's E and R. There's a difference in the kind of the language there. So
is it a feminine, masculine?
Exactly.
Term?
So when I was a kid, I would always use the man one, the male one, and often I would get scolded by my mom. It's like, what the hell is wrong with you? And I remember, my youngest brother was born. He was always using the female one, so it's like, ooh, but not trying to say anything about him because he's still 9, and he's still probably not sure. So anyhow, back to me. So I was always it's through that I kind of remember that for a long time I was using the masculine one because the feminine one didn't make sense to me. And eventually I started using the feminine one, and it wasn't until when I was 20, I actually came out as bisexual, but I didn't really realize I was bisexual until I was 18. So, yeah, it took a long time for me. It didn't just come like a revelation from Angel Gabriel. Hey, you're bi.
Flies away. So what do you think kind of, I mean, you say it's a slow process, but do you think there was anything in particular where you kind
of had
a bit of an awakening?
It is always also that, you know, the problem with being bi is that you're kind of hetero. So you're already attracted to the opposite sex.
Well,
that's
you can hide.
So,
the one I use, I think, sometimes I've spoken about, you can always pretend to be straight anyway.
Anyway, yeah. So I guess, so I was straight and I definitely, like, I was like, yeah, I'm attracted to men. And then, you know, and then women kind of, you know, I would look at them, oh, she's so pretty. And then it's not until, you know, the sexual thoughts kind of come through to you and they're like, why am I not disgusted by it or find it awkward? I don't. I find it quite comfortable. And but the only thing is, yeah, it's the biological thing that I still want, like, biological kids, and I'm not in for that sperm donation and all that. Yeah, that's not me, man. That's American. I don't know. But anyhow, that's how I understood bisexuality as. And yeah, it's just not something that, you know, you can't really tell when you look
and
at
it. And do you think, when you sort of started to realize that, do you think you pushed away at all, or was it something that you were quite happy to accept?
I think for me, one of the consequences of being a bisexual was the fact that I could not marry a Pakistani man anymore. So, which was actually not a loss at the end of the day, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, some of them may be hot or whatever, but point is that the society there is not that accepting of women in general, let alone gay or bisexual people. Though I have my own theory, though. I think everyone's born bisexual. We choose to be hetero, homo, or bi.
I think as people talk about that, you know, when we talk about sexuality being fluid, it's sort of all on a spectrum, and so probably to some degree everyone is something, but maybe, you know, obviously a lot of people are on extreme one end or the other, but
that's right.
Very few are on the absolute extreme.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, obviously I've considered, you know, I always say to my my friends that if I'm single by the time I'm 35, then...
I already... Okay, that's so, it. Let's do it.
Then I'm, going to end up with a woman screw men.
So is it... I'm assuming it's very important to you that you sort of marry someone who's Muslim. That seems to be a bit in the direction that you've gone.
Actually, no. He or she, well, probably he, doesn't have to be a Muslim, because, as I said earlier, that I found it very difficult to resonate with Shia and Sunni sects, which are the two mainstreams of Islam. So for me, it's I kind of prefer the person to be spiritual. I don't think I can ever be with an atheist. It doesn't matter whether it's a woman or a man. I just don't think I can have a relationship with an atheist. For me, it has to be with someone that has a spiritual side. And not just, oh, yeah, I'm spiritual. What do you do about spirituality? Like, nothing. Okay, well, do something. You know, maybe someone like, probably someone from a Hindu or a Buddhist background, Taoist, or I know shamanism.
Right, yeah. So that's an interesting. So you're happy to more than say, you know, I'm happy to comfortably date people of other backgrounds and
absolutely as long as, you know, because for me it's not necessarily about, because people often ask me, well, then your kids would be non-Muslims, and I'm like, actually, that's not guaranteed. I mean, the fact that I want to give my kids a choice to choose their own path rather than enforcing them with one or the other path. And I don't think my kids would be both. I don't think that's even possible. I think kids or people in general stick to one dominant identity eventually. So given that, I feel that people, I think people do over-speculate and over-assume things. And a lot of these people that do that, they tend to be afraid of taking risks in life. And I think life without risks is pretty not very fun.
You say you're more than happy to, as much as I'm sure you would like, any hypothetical children to sort of identify with, the background of their mother, but they may or may not.
Exactly. And also it's like, you know, Tal, at the end of the day, it's even if I don't marry, even if I marry a Pakistani or a Muslim, my kids won't, my kids' kids won't. Their kids won't. So it's like eventually
someone won't.
That's the whole thing. And so you can't kind of prevent it.
Now, I think you mentioned earlier you find things like interfaith quite important.
Absolutely.
One of the big barriers sometimes that I've found in my own work in interfaith is that people are concerned about concepts like intermarriage, especially the idea of, you know, if we get young people together, what if they start intermarrying? Have you seen those same sort of reactions?
Absolutely, and I think that's where there's a strong trend in the Muslim community that the girls tend to stick around with Muslim girls and the boys, Muslim boys, tend to stick around with Muslim boys. And even together, they don't really interact as much because the permission and the influence of their parents is still very, very important part of their life, which is obviously very different to how it would be for me. Because for me, my parents are there. Yes, I respect them and I love them and they love me. And they have accepted me, and they're accepting of gay people as well. However, at the same time, you know, when it comes down to intermarriages, they would have like, oh, do you have to marry an Indian? You know, like Pakistan keep losing those matches against India in cricket. And, you know, there's that resentment. There's that resentment. It's just like...
And that's the concern, the cricket. But it's certainly, I think, I mean, as much as you point out the Muslim community, I mean, I think we see it obviously across the board. I certainly see it in the Jewish community, but we see it everywhere, right? A lot of the backgrounds would like to... you know, if they had a choice, they would like their children to, you know, keep the faith alive.
That's right.
As it goes on. But do you, yeah, like I said, in terms of involvement in interfaith, do you see that then? What are you seeing as, because I think you kind of said that you'd like to see more interfaith going on, or is that a need? Or do you think, what do you think stopping that?
I think there's several things that's stopping interfaith. One is the lack of social communication skills that a lot of Muslim women don't have. Because, well, if you only interact with girls that are in your school, or when you go out, you're with girls again, and then when you pray together, you're with girls again. It's just like, well, that's not really kind of helping you develop skills with men or people of the opposite gender. And for that, you need to go out in your community. You need to work outside your community. And in general, I think you need to be very brave as a person. When I left home at 16 and started to live by myself, like, I was the first girl in my family to be doing that. Like, and at the time, nobody in my family accepted me, but now everyone's like, oh, Rita is so awesome. She just goes around, eats whatever the type of food she likes and the dresses she can wear, and she can buy whatever she wants. And I think it's that the lack of ability in your own, lack of faith in your own ability to socially interact with and find good people. I think people are scared of getting hurt by the non-Muslims within the Muslim community because of the aggressive media, American media approaches, because of the stories they hear from their fellow female Muslim friends, which I have to say is a lot of them may be biased and probably one-sided, not necessarily the other side. And I think in general, it's about being open. And being brave, that's all I would say is what's stopping people. People are so afraid. People are so uncomfortable.
Though I imagine that it would be quite difficult to do for many people who can then therefore kind of be, I guess, opening up themselves to be victims of Islamophobia.
Yeah, and I think at the same time, it's that victim mentality in our own community that I'm a Muslim and I don't get a job because I'm a Muslim, whereas like, well, maybe that's not the reason. Maybe you're not getting a job because of other reasons, because I'm not getting a job or you know, there's lots of young Australians right now that are unemployed, but you're not alone. So I don't know. I think often they tend to feel very alone in the journey, and I think they need to be reminded time and time again that they're not alone. And certainly I felt alone at some point, but with my interaction through non-Muslims and Australians and people from different cultural backgrounds, I've realized that I'm not alone at all.
And you're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9.
The Woods, Joy 94.9's show for bears, the bear community, and supporters. Join me, Big Bear Mark, Dean, and Matt for all things Ursine and Hirsute, Thursdays, 9 p.m.
The Woods is proudly sponsored by AdonisPlays.com, the best quality adult products from a gay-owned and run business right here in Melbourne. Discover the range of kink and specialty items today at Adonis Plays, for those who know what they want.
AdonisPlays.com, playing your way.
Tune in each Monday at midday for Been There, Done That, hosted by Gordon, Phil and me, Chris. A light-hearted one-hour chat show highlighting gay icons, dicons and bicons, those pioneers in the gay and broader communities, events in history that still affect our lives, and useless pieces of trivia. With thanks to Living Positive Victoria, help us to stamp out syphilis in Victoria. If you've had syphilis in the past, you can get it again. Get tested and treated at your next regular checkup.
And you're listening to the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. And faithful listeners, we've come to the end of another show. Now, I wanted, of course, thank Rita. Thank you very much.
No worries.
I've greatly enjoyed. Normally, this is the sort of time when it was if you were part of an organization where I'd be like, and yeah, how can they get involved or something like that. But I think probably instead I'll use this time just to say, you know, thank you so much. As I sometimes say, I do want to try and get as many different people on as possible from all sorts of different backgrounds.
Sure.
And sort of give us a little bit about, you know, where they're coming from, what they've been doing. But I hope it's been very informative for people, obviously.
Yeah, Sufism. Just look us up, you know. I know there's only 100 of us in Victoria, but so it's a evolving faith.
And but you guys meet quite often, right?
On that's right. We have Sufi nights in Melbourne every second, once a fortnight, on Thursday nights. And there's one that's called the International Sufi Movement. Then the other one is the Ansari Sufi Order, run by Sheikh Ibrahim, who's a musician and an ex-Jewish Californian. So
wow,
yeah, different, very different from a lot of other.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm sure that some of those would be very, very interesting. But been listening to the Spirit Lounge. Good night from Tal
and Rita.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.